Going Linux, Episode 8, Listener Feedback. Welcome to the Going Linux Podcast. I'm your host, Larry Bushy. Going Linux is a podcast for computer users who just want to use Linux to get things done. Whether you are new to Linux, moving from Windows to Linux, or if you're just thinking about moving to Linux, this podcast will provide you with practical day-to-day advice on how to use Linux. Our goal is to help make the Linux experience easy for you. In the user experience episodes of Going Linux, we take 2 months to cover a topic. During the first month, we cover a general introduction to the topic, and we include topics of interest to switchers to Linux. During the second month, we cover the more advanced topics for users of Linux trying to build their confidence and competence with their new operating system. Between user experience episodes, we have listener feedback episodes like this one. During the listener feedback episodes, we answer listener questions and provide additional information on how to use Linux. Our email address is goinglinux@gmail.com, and our website is goinglinux.com. On the website, we have show notes, articles, information, and detailed instructions with screenshots on the topics we cover during the episodes. Today, as I mentioned, is our listener feedback episode. We hope you'll have some fun, learn some things, and gain the confidence you need to adopt Linux, as I've done, as the main operating system for your computer. We've received quite a bit of email since last month's listener feedback episode. At the beginning of last month, I received a message from a listener who, like many of you, is installing the latest version of Ubuntu, version 7.04, Feisty Fawn. Bill C. from Indiana describes his trials and tribulations when installing Feisty 7.04 with only a dial-up connection. Although the Linux community would like to be able to say that everything, quote, just works, sometimes it doesn't. If you've listened to any of the Linux Install podcast episodes, you'll know what I mean. Check it out at thelip.net. During the process of installing his new operating system, Bill makes some interesting points about Linux, Windows, and the process of installing Linux. I'm sure many of you will be able to empathize as well. Bill C. from Indiana writes, Linux Demons et al. You may find this amusing, but I just succeeded in downloading Ubuntu 7.04 on dial-up. 3 days, 698 megabytes in about 10 chunks from University of Utah. I write the following as a kind of catharsis and conversation with myself, so it may not be of any use as teaching material. Out of a sense of preparedness and a plan for eventual defensive migration from entrapment by the Windows DRM and its attendant commercial advertising imperative, I made a serious commitment to install at least one flavor of Linux on one of three machines. I write this from the perspective of a somewhat baffled new user. I'm puzzled about the OS and means of making use of it, and puzzled by the seeming myopia of the Linux development community. It is generally understood that Ubuntu, Kubuntu are the easiest to learn distributions with a graphical user interface introduction to Linux. I have some suspicions that the Fedora Red Hat bunch may have some advantages, but I'm well rutted on this canonical road and will stick with it for now. No modem support. Depending on region, 20 to 30% of home users are still on dial-up. This is a big slice of the market to just wipe off. Even with an utterly generic external serial modem, I find there is no GNOME point-to-point protocol or PPE dialer included with my ISO download. The package manager cannot find and load GNOME PPP when I somehow trick the modem to dial out. Struggling to use the command line with things like wvdial is impossible. This is idiocy. Of all things to leave out of a package to make it fit on a CD, online access isn't one of them. After looking at the nonsense involved in finding a driver for a WIN modem, I searched for months to find a cheap, pristine V90 serial modem. Obviously, I was in no particular hurry. Good thing. Note to development community. Put a dialer in the included list of applications or accessories. Also, the network settings will not stick, so must be reconfigured every time I start the system. For some reason, it likes to pulse rather than tone. Quaint, if not musical. You guys are embarrassing me because I want to brag about how easy it was to get up and running, and I don't want to tell a lie. LCD monitor resolution. Why is it that a 10-year-old operating system, Windows 98 2nd Edition, can sense and establish the native resolution of a monitor that wasn't even invented when the operating system was created? Yes, I know the Dell 815 845 driver set is relatively new. Ubuntu cannot see this device, and so I must search for workarounds and updates on a brand new operating system. I did find a surefire fix-it site, which more or less guarantees that I will have my native 1280 by 1024 resolution. And then I couldn't make the modem redial, so that fix is on hold for now. Desktop real estate has a high value, and the system using Linux is only workable if I can get the same or better workspace as Windows. This is of prime importance, by the way. Just curious, but why is my Firefox icon as big as a doorknob? Not all is misery. There are some small triumphs. Ubuntu 6.06 was insistent that I use CUPS and something called Localhost 631 to configure my old Lexmark printer. I can only say that standing around at a cocktail party spouting obscurities like localhost :631 might be the computerese equivalent of quoting the Virta in Sanskrit. On arriving, Ubuntu 7.04 found the printer, installed the driver, and it actually works. However, there is something called SANE that needs to be found to make the scanner work as well. I don't like the sound of that. I tried the Kubuntu interface. I have got to tell you that it takes talent to make a graphical user interface more obtuse than a command line. Please, gentlemen, why bother? If it's a graphical user interface you want, use it to group similar functions in the same menu. Jeez. On the whole, I have to say that good intentions won't make up for pulling out of the station late. The polymorphic diffusion of effort in the Linux community slows progress. I realize it is the prerogative of intensely egocentric individuals to continue to insist that more variety is better, an aphorism with absolutely no factual basis of support. Depending on case, variety can be better or worse. In terms of building anything, coordination, group effort, harmony, and concentration of purpose always triumphs over a fragmented cause. On the other hand, if all this twiddling keeps them off the streets and out of trouble, can't be all bad. More later. Well, thanks, Bill. That was a very interesting email. All I can say right now regarding your modem issues is that they call it a win modem for a reason, and it's not because it has a winning personality. On the issues of Ubuntu/Kubuntu versus other distributions, certainly Canonical's distributions are fast becoming the most popular, and I see that as a good thing. As you observed, the fragmentation of the Linux development effort among the various distributions has its advantages. I think that at least some consolidation in this area could help. I'm hoping that one of the current distributions pulls ahead of the pack and gets adopted by the community of average desktop users in much greater numbers than the others. This would force some intense competition for the others to stay alive, and would also force the leading distribution to put more effort into ensuring that everything works out of the box. I see some signs that Ubuntu is beginning to take the lead, but I'm also sure that obtaining that kind of a lead is, at least in part, behind Novell's non-aggression pact with Microsoft. In today's world, not all hardware works with all Linux distributions. In fact, some hardware doesn't work with Linux at all. That is one of the reasons that live CDs are a good idea. I know that your connection to the internet is dial-up, and that's just one more CD for some distributions that you would have to download, but they do let you test the distribution with your hardware before you install the software. Unfortunately, Choosing a distribution is sometimes a matter of finding one that works with your hardware. For example, at work I have a relatively new Lenovo ThinkPad T60 computer. Although my company insists on not using any software that doesn't have Windows or four Windows in its name, I use a spare hard drive to test Linux distributions on relatively recent hardware. I found that the same version of OpenSUSE 10.2 that would not run on my personal laptop installed and ran perfectly on the T60. On the other hand, although Ubuntu Edgy 6.10 worked just fine on both systems, that was not the case with the latest version of Ubuntu. The feisty 7.04 version of Ubuntu and Kubuntu installed just fine on my personal laptop, but caused me all kinds of problems when I tried to install it on the T60. The display still doesn't work right, and there's no hope that I'll be able to get Barrel running on it. Even with these issues, I still believe Linux is ready for the average desktop user. Something that the vast majority of users never have to do with Windows is install it. I have installed various versions of Windows on multiple computers. The process of installing Windows is no less fraught with trouble. Linux will need a little more help from the support communities and from people like me, but I think it's worth the effort to go through the installation process to get a dependable, free operating system that comes pre-configured with 80 to 90% of the software that most users need. We still have a ways to go before we have a perfect operating system, but I also know that if we ever get there, as soon as we have, something will change and it will no longer be perfect. I sent Bill an email in response, and in a follow-up email, Bill explains, "I try to keep such projects in the non-critical mode and maintain the light side. However, I get the feeling that there are lots of people out there, both devotees of Linux and frustrated newbies, who take these things far more seriously. There may be a critical need involved which adds a lot of pressure to get the thing up and running. Maybe what I need is a book like one of Marcel Gagné's Ubuntu series. We have a Fry's in Indianapolis, and I'm going to zoom down there and see what I can find. I'm trying to keep this project on a shoestring budget. I could have had this all done by hiring it out or just buying a ready-made Linspire-type box, but I really do live on shoestrings. Another thing is overall optimum hardware compatibility. As you so well described, the fit on a variety of systems, depending on distribution, is chancy. Obviously, this is a lot of what Microsoft does, making a general-purpose operating system almost universal across all platforms. Of course, the hardware manufacturers make their bits and pieces conform to the Microsoft specs, so there is almost the suspicion of mutual hostility toward outsiders, but I wouldn't stoop to suggest a conspiracy. That is another realm where a more concentrated single-purpose development effort could have more influence. I think there is a philosophical struggle in the, quote, community, with some against too much ease of graphical user interface conformity. This may be borderline subconscious resistance to making things too easy and eroding the haughty exclusivity of being a know-it-all. Human nature being what it is, some people mark among their possessions some special field of knowledge or expertise and resent a reduction in their sense of self-importance. It may be that something as simple as insufficient product testing by unbiased eyes. Do development teams conduct torture tests by bringing in non-adept new users to check their logic? There are many very accomplished people in the world who solve complex problems but have no prejudicial thought process based on the traditions and tricks common to Unix, Linux, or even PCs in general. I think you can have your cake and eat it too, building logical, consistent, graphical user interface which makes the few steps of package installation and system maintenance repetitive and accessible and still keep the command line versatility underneath. In small towns, there is almost no way to get a hands-on demonstration of Linux. We are building a community college here in this little town, something the civic leaders are quite proud of, but there are no scheduled computer classes on Linux there or at the county library. I'm an outsider here, and I bring my cosmopolitan sensibilities with me, but the norm is accept what is easily available at Walmart or Best Buy. There is some evidence of a passing Memphis medicine show. Several small, hole-in-the-wall PC repair shops have boxes of Memphis distributions purchased several years ago that lay collecting dust unsold. The gypsy tinker neglected to tell them that the Linux operating system is open and free. Bill C. Thanks again, Bill, for your commentary. In the interest of not making this the Bill C. listener feedback episode, let's take a look at another email, this one from Mike P. I listened to a back issue of one of your podcasts where one of you asked about a way to send a print job from Firefox to PDF. There is a way for KDE users. Printing to PDF from Firefox is unbelievably easy. It may even be possible to do similar things using GNOME, but as I'm not a GNOME user, I can't offer you any guidance. When you have a page that you want to print displayed in Firefox, click on File, Print. And in the printer selection combo box, choose PostScript from the list of available or installed printers. Then click the Properties button. Then clear the command box and type in KPrinter. That's KPrinter. Then click on OK. Then on Print, and the print job will be passed on to the KDE printer, where the option for PDF creation is there by default if you have all the prerequisites already met. That is the CUPS-PDF package. From now on, whenever the user chooses PostScript from the Firefox printer dialog, the KPrinter option will be remembered. This will call up the KDE printer dialog, and you can choose Print to PDF or whatever else is available. Mike P. Hey Mike, thanks for that feedback. I tried your suggestion under both KDE and GNOME, and it works. I think maybe that it may have worked for me under GNOME only because I have both KDE and GNOME installed on my computer. I haven't found a way to install KPrinter using Synaptic or Adept, and I suspect it's not installed by default under GNOME if you don't install the KDE packages. Either way, this is an excellent tip, Mike. Thanks. Now some feedback from James F. I've been dabbling in Linux for a number of years, but always found the installation and configuration process too painful. A number of years ago, I found the Corel distribution and thought it was the easiest at that time. Corel sold their Linux distribution to Zandros, and I feel they have improved it. I listen to a number of Linux podcasts and almost never hear Zandros distribution mentioned, and I'm wondering why Zandros isn't mentioned. I think it's a great option for a Linux newbie. I currently own the Zandros business distribution and really like it. I believe it took me 4 clicks to install, plus I found it configured all of my hardware. Can you give me a little insight as to why Zandros seems to be overlooked? One of the nice features of Zandros is that it comes with a copy of Crossover, a Wine implementation that allows a number of Windows applications to be run on Linux. Even though I have dabbled with Linux for a number of years, I am still a newbie. Since I'm not enamored with Vista, I am giving Linux a very serious look and will probably make it my desktop. As I mentioned, I listen to a number of Linux podcasts, but have found the ones that say that they are for newbies talk too much about things that I feel will very quickly turn off a person moving from Windows. That is, reliance on using the terminal windows and the command line. I've been around computers since the command line was the only interface, and the computer industry would not be where it is today if the graphical user interface had not been implemented. I have listened to 2 of your podcasts, and it is hitting the mark. Please stay true to what you outline in your introduction podcast. Great show, James F. A little bit later, James sent me another email as a brief follow-up saying, I think you should have a show or at least a segment on the Crossover product from Codeweavers. I think the Crossover product could be a big help for people switching from Windows to Linux, especially if they have some Windows program that doesn't have a good Linux equivalent. You might also want to contrast it to Wine, which Crossover is based on. Well, James, I'm particularly pleased that you think that the Going Linux podcast hits the mark. That tells me that we're reaching our target market. I want to reassure you and our other listeners that I have no intention of changing the flavor of the podcast. Just as you mentioned, there are quite a few other podcasts, but none really address the absolute newbie switching from Windows. I want ours to continue to focus on giving step-by-step practical information on the graphical way to do things in Linux. You asked about Zandros. I have certainly heard of Zandros, but I have never tried it myself. Personally, I think that the fact that it has a $100 US price tag has hindered its popularity. When you can get Ubuntu or any of its derivatives and many other distributions for no charge, it's tough to justify spending $100, especially when you aren't yet convinced that Linux is for you. My co-host for the first four episodes, Serge, intended to include an installation of Zandros on his The Linux Install podcast, but until he finds a new host for the LIP, that'll have to stay on hold. I have used Wine, and in fact, I have installed Internet Explorer 6 under Wine so that I can test my website using IE. But I have not yet tried Crossover Office. I noticed that it is available in the Ubuntu repositories. Maybe when I have a little time, I'll give it a try. Thanks for listening, James, and I think you'll like the additional topics that we have coming up on Going Linux. John L. sent us an email and asked a question that I know is on the mind of many of you listening to the Going Linux podcast. John says, "Hello, I recently downloaded your podcast and love it. The question I have is, which distro is a good distro to start with? I run currently a PowerPC G4 laptop and a Windows XP machine that is around 7 years old. Picked it up when Pentium 4 had just scratched the market. Thanks in advance, John." After reading my response, in which I suggested that John try out Ubuntu and OpenSUSE, John sent me a response saying, "Thank you very much for your quick reply. I will look into Ubuntu and OpenSUSE. I have always been interested in Linux, especially after a few nicely colored blue screens. I hope my search is as satisfying as buying a new piece of hardware. In case you were wondering, my PowerPC is a G4 15-inch aluminum PowerBook with 1.5 gigs of RAM running OS 10.4.9. Well, thanks for those emails, John. I'm really glad that you liked the podcast. And if you like what we've covered so far, you'll definitely like what's coming up. Regarding which distro to start with, as you already know from reading my response to your email, I normally recommend a couple of different distributions that are easily installed and are newbie-friendly. The most popular distribution today seems to be Ubuntu. My usual first recommendation, however, is Kubuntu, the version of Ubuntu that's pre-configured with the KDE desktop. You can get that at www.ubuntu.com, and you spell Ubuntu, U-B-U-N-T-U. The Ubuntu/Kubuntu community provides excellent support, especially for newbies. Another distribution I would recommend is OpenSUSE, available at opensuse.org, O-P-E-N-S-U-S-E. .org. When you install OpenSUSE, you are asked to choose which desktop environment to use. And again, I would choose KDE to start with. You can always install any other desktop environment later, and that goes for almost any distribution you could choose to start with. To some degree, which one is right for you depends on how old your hardware is and how much RAM you have installed. The more RAM, the better, of course, but Linux is not nearly as demanding as Windows, especially Windows Vista. You should be able to have a reasonably speedy installation with at least 256 megabytes of RAM. I have a couple of 1999 vintage computers that have been able to handle some of the more recent distributions, so I think your XP machine should be okay with just about any distribution. I'm not so sure about the PowerPC, mainly because I don't have a lot of experience with Mac. The quickest way to test whether a distribution will work is to start with a live CD or live DVD. That will allow you to boot from the CD or DVD into a fully operational version of the distribution, except that it's not yet installed on your hard drive. It's running from the CD. If it runs without any problem from the CD, it's 99% sure that everything will install and run flawlessly when you do install it. For your Windows machine, you can download the Kubuntu Live CD at kubuntu.org/download.php. And for all of these websites, of course, we'll have links in our show notes. On that site, you're looking for the desktop version for X386. Burn the image to a blank disk and then boot to the CD. You'll have a fully functional Kubuntu system at that point. Once you've determined that it works with your hardware, just click the install icon that appears on the Kubuntu desktop to begin the installation. You can download the OpenSUSE Live DVD from opensuse.org/released_version. Unfortunately, you can't install OpenSUSE from the Live DVD, at least last time I tried. So to install the operating system, you'll need to return to the site to download the installation DVD or the 5-CD set plus the non-open source add-on CD. Certainly not something Bill C wants to do with his dial-up connection, I'm sure. The good news with OpenSUSE is that it also has a version for your PowerPC. If you had an even older computer, or if you were limited to 128 megs of RAM or less, I'd be recommending something else, but I think either of these will do for you as you've described your hardware. So good luck with whichever distribution you finally decide to use, and let me know how it goes. Okay, and here's the latest update from Bill C. in Indiana. He writes another email saying, "Hi Larry, since you were kind enough to respond and take some interest in my migration to Ubuntu," maybe I shouldn't have done that, "I thought I'd send you this other transmission I had with Craig and Carrie on Computer America, who regularly have Marcel Gagné on every Tuesday night. Mine isn't that interesting a technical problem, but I think my plight may be of interest to all of us in favor of greater Linux market share. Ease of conversion from Windows to Linux is a nut worth cracking." Bill outlines his system as follows. A Dell Optiplex GX150, common as fleas, he says. Intel GX150 815/G/EG/P/EP. Alphabet soup, I think, Solano chipset. Intel CPU Coppermine 1 GHz Celeron with onboard video Intel 82815 graphics will run 1280 by 1024 in Windows 98 SE on a CRT. This thing is quiet as a mouse and slow. The monitor is an LG L1932TQ Flattron 19-inch. Now that we've covered Bill's technical specs, let's listen in to some of the trials and tribulations he has with this interchange with Computer America. Ubuntu 7.04 generic driver does not offer higher than 1024 by 768 in system preferences screen resolution options. I'm instructed to download Universe and Multiverse repositories to obtain 915 resolution drivers. This, quote, flexible driver, unquote, allows customizing resolution to non-standard values. There are many such named items in the repositories, and I cannot discover which one I should download unless I'm looking in the wrong place. I am searching Synaptic Package Manager on the internet connection. All system updates are completed last time I connected to the internet, and I was also instructed to use the terminal to modify X Graphics Configuration Manager with dire warnings that I should back up xorg.config because any misstep will lead to a disaster. Blank screen, unbootable system, plague of locusts, volcanic eruption, asteroid collision. I had similar problems getting my printer, the Lexmark X73, working with Ubuntu 6.06. Printer works in 7.04. I have not yet got a scanner working with the sane twain driver, which I dread. I simply gave up trying to discern which of the several Win modems I have work with Ubuntu Linux, and found an old Zoom V90 external serial modem for a few bucks that works transparently with the generic driver. I have to load and experiment with WVDial, as the network utility persists in using pulse mode and sometimes reverts to Ethernet instead of the modem checkbox. When I restart and look at the system admin network settings, there is no simple dial command to connect. I expect, what a fool, that once Ubuntu had found the modem and it was configured with a number and password, it would sense loading the browser and automatically connect like Windows does. Connectivity is largely solved with broadband. However, 25% of the market is still on dial-up. I'm going to continue attempting to get Ubuntu or something like it up and running and gradually take over Windows functions. However you want to paint it, Linux is not ready for the masses. The technology is there, amazing development has been done. However, developers who are immersed in the details of command line administration of the system cannot seem to adopt an innocent view of the operating system. There is a fundamental conflict with the techie nerd ethos that if it's too easy and transparent and sophisticated, it can't be as good as complex, inconsistent, and obtuse. The hierarchy of techie status is based on the conquest of arcane and non-apparent relationships of functional bits and pieces. It is a difference in concept, like the flexibility of Legos versus the limited versatility of prefab kits. Perhaps developers need to go outside of the Linux community to test for consistent and rational menu design and driver installation. I realize the Linux people are swimming in shark-infested waters. The greed and narrowness of commercial developers, large and small, is illustrative. They maneuver to destroy Linux development as parallel to life, based on stealing the work of others. Commercial software developers who rely on unethical distortion of patent law to crush harmonious competition remind me of primitive, tribal, infanticidal brutes. Bill, use smaller words, okay? Who cannot stand the birth of a child in a rival clan. Some may be embarrassed that they have difficulty in keeping up with commercial Linux Unix systems, which are advanced and improved voluntarily in spare time. Well, Bill, you seem to be straddling both sides of the fence here. You're criticizing Linux and you're criticizing Windows, and to be quite honest, there's probably plenty of criticism to be had on both sides. Certainly, your situation illustrates many of the problems that new Linux users have in installing Linux on their computers. As I mentioned earlier, that's something that most Windows users never have to do, and there can be just as many nightmare situations in trying to install Windows on a system as you've been experiencing. The good news is that if you can find a Linux distribution that works very well with your hardware using live CDs, live DVDs, or other test installations, you're usually pretty well off once you've got it installed. There will always be hardware issues, and Win modem, of course, is short for Windows modem, and it, of course, relies on Windows to be able to operate. So that is definitely one of your issues with the Win modems you were trying to originally install. Some printers can be troublesome as well, and scanners are particularly difficult under some distributions of Linux. And quite frankly, that's not the fault of Linux developers. It's the hardware manufacturers that are at fault, especially when they make drivers proprietary and don't make their technical requirements available for operating systems developers. Canon, for example, is one manufacturer that has woefully poor compatibility with its scanners. Hewlett-Packard, on the other hand, tends to be one of the most compatible. This is actually to be expected since HP contributes a lot to the open source community. If you're going to be buying hardware, before you buy, check out the hardware compatibility lists that are available for Linux. We have links on our show notes and articles in the resources pages of the Going Linux website. Check those out. And just as products that are designed by engineers are usually designed for engineers, software designed by programmers is often usable only by those programmers. That's why it's necessary to test with real-life users. And Bill, I'm sure you'll agree with me there. It's getting better as Linux becomes more popular with novice users, with more focus on the graphical user interface versus the command line. My hope is that this trend and shows like the Going Linux podcast will help drive the adoption of Linux, in turn driving usability, increased adoption, and finally increased motivation to make Linux easier to use and more compatible with all hardware. Our next email is from George M., who writes, "I just listened to Episode 6, Listener Feedback. I was so impressed that I had to give you a job well done. It was very well organized and easy to listen to, and was obviously well prepared. I am sure you spent a lot of time organizing all that information. I also appreciate how open you are to different points of view. This is often not easy to do, as we are so different and have different needs and views. Please keep up the great work you are doing. Very helpful. Sincerely, George." Well, thank you very much for your email, George. As you know, if you've been listening to the past few episodes, I really appreciate feedback from listeners to the podcast. I try to be open to different points of view, and I know that there are many podcasts out there. Several of them qualify as Linux evangelist type shows. Some of them even take every opportunity to bash both Microsoft and Apple and make Linux out to be the, quote, perfect operating system. In my opinion, the reality is that there is no perfect operating system. Microsoft has the lion's share of the market, and software developers address Windows first, but it certainly has security issues and is generally viewed as extremely slow and bloated. Apple's OS X is pretty and popular with those involved in the media arts, but it is even more proprietary and purported to be more expensive than Windows. And OS X is reported as well to be becoming more like Windows in terms of bloat every day. Linux is freely available at little or no financial cost. It is infinitely configurable and extensible, and it is extremely well supported by a huge community of developers and users. The downsides to Linux include that the community is fragmented, as I mentioned earlier on in this episode, and competes with itself to some degree. It is difficult for the novice user to understand the differences between distributions, and there is a significant delay to get support for some of the most recent computer hardware. That lack of rapid development of hardware support is, I think, mainly because of the hardware manufacturers' lack of focus on the Linux market rather than Linux developers themselves. I'm pleased that you like the show and find it of value, and I hope you stick with us for future episodes and recommend the show to all of your friends. George, thanks for listening. Our last email is from Frank. And Frank writes, "I hear you talk about subscribing to the podcast at the end of each episode. I've just been going to your website and downloading. How do I subscribe? Will my iPod still work when I install Linux?" Well, Frank, let's talk about that. And yes, your iPod will work under Linux. On the Going Linux website, we've noticed that our existing subscribers are about half using iTunes and half using the many other versions of podcast receiving software that's out there. And yet there are others who just download each episode when it becomes available, like Frank does. So what is subscribing? It's using software to check whether there's a new podcast episode available. And if there is, it's downloaded automatically by that software. It provides you a way to get it onto your iPod or whatever other media player you're using, or play it right there on your computer. So why would you want to do that at all? Well, first of all, by subscribing to a podcast, you don't have to monitor the website to see when a new episode is available, and you don't have to wait for it to download. It happens automatically. You can subscribe to as many podcasts as you want, and your software will download the new episodes as soon as they're ready. My iPod is always full with enough podcasts to last most of every day during the week. So how do I do it? Well, on the Going Linux website that describes just that, how to subscribe to a podcast. Although it's called subscribing, as I've just described, you're really just adding the podcast to your receiving software, and of course, it's free. All podcasts will have a link to what's called a feed published somewhere on their website or blog page for the podcast. You can usually easily spot the link because it's an orange and white RSS or XML logo. Recently, Mozilla.org has proposed a common icon for those feeds that's become quite popular. It's an orange square with what looks like sound waves emanating from the lower left-hand corner to the upper right. You'll see that icon for the Going Linux feeds on our website in the left-hand margin. Sometimes the feed icon looks a little bit different, and sometimes it's just a regular text-based web link. Regardless of how it appears for the podcast that you want to subscribe to, the instructions for subscribing are basically the same. So let me describe for our Linux users how to subscribe using Amarok, which is a KDE podcast receiving software and media playing software. And for our GNOME users, I'll describe how to subscribe using Rhythmbox software. Of course, either software will work under either window manager, so you can use Amarok under GNOME just as easily as you can use it under KDE, and so on. So for subscribing using Amarok, first locate the podcast feed link or icon or however it appears on the website or the blog page for that podcast. Right-click the link or the feed icon and copy the URL path for the podcast feed. This is usually a standard URL that begins http://, and often ends with a file name that has an extension XML or RSS. But if your particular link doesn't have those, don't worry about it, just copy the link location. Next, in Amarok, open the Playlists panel. Right-click Podcasts in the list. Select Add Podcast from the menu that appears. It's the icon labeled with a plus sign. The Add Podcast dialog box then opens up. Paste the URL that you copied earlier into the Enter Podcast URL field. Click OK. The podcast is now located and the episodes are added to the playlist. You can play them right away as streaming audio, but they're not actually downloaded to your hard drive until you complete the next step. If you want to do that, right-click the name of the podcast that you just subscribed to, as it appears in the list, and select Configure to change how and where the episodes are downloaded. For Rhythmbox users, as for Amarok, right-click on the link on the website or blog page for the podcast that you want to subscribe to. Copy the URL path for the podcast feed. In Rhythmbox, click Podcasts in the Source panel. Next, select New Podcast Feed from the toolbar. The New Podcast Feed dialog box will open up. Paste the URL into the URL from Podcast Feed field. Click Add. The podcast feed is located and episodes are added to the playlist automatically. Rhythmbox immediately begins downloading the latest episode into the player. For those of you who are still on Windows, there are a number of podcatchers you can use, not the least of which is iTunes. You can find many podcasts in the iTunes Music Store and subscribe to them right there. Going Linux is listed in iTunes as well. If you're interested in the step-by-steps on how to use iTunes to subscribe to a podcast or other podcatching software for Windows, check out the article on the Going Linux website. Dave Jackson of the School of Podcasting has a website called learntosubscribe.com. If you're a Windows or Mac user, Dave has some very nice instructions on how to subscribe. Unfortunately, they don't include Linux instructions. That's what we're here for at Going Linux. And that's it for this episode of Going Linux. In our next user experience episode, we'll be talking about adjusting to Linux. We'll discuss things you can do in Windows and how you can do them in Linux under KDE. We'll include getting help for Linux and Linux applications, and we'll have some resources and references on how to get the most of your distribution's support community website and more. So for more information on the topics that I've discussed here and the suggestions that I've had for our listeners who have generously provided us with their feedback, go to the show notes at goinglinux.com and feel free to email us with comments, questions, and suggestions. Our email address is goinglinux@gmail.com. Subscribe to the podcast to get future episodes delivered automatically. The instructions you've just heard and are on our website as well. Thanks for listening. Theme music provided by Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com.